Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I'm going to bet that hardly any of you out there had ever heard of Zoom before about March or April of 2020. Maybe WebEx if you work for the government or a big company, or certainly Skype, but not Zoom. Neither had I, and I've worked remotely for over 30 years now. But now I regularly have meetings on Zoom, Microsoft Teams, WebEx, and more obscure remote meeting platforms like RingCentral and BlueJeans and Uber Conference and Slack. And because it doesn't involve travel, I'm in more meetings now than ever before. And apart from taking up a lot of time, they're actually pretty productive. But during this pandemic, because it's gone on so long, what used to be an alternative to the in-person office, maybe a day or week to work from home, has pretty quickly become the standard. Employers have found that workers actually do work well when they're home, and most workers love not having to put on office attire and commute to and from the office. It saves money and time and often improves family life. Maybe it complicates it if you have kids at home, right? But generally, it has a lot of advantages. So the big question is, what's the long-term impact of this explosion of remote working activity? Beyond the implications for the structure of work itself, what are the ramifications for cities, for their downtowns, their office buildings, their transportation and communication infrastructures, for all those things that make our big, complex modern cities? These are big, important questions, and my two guests today are well-equipped to talk about them. One is Professor Carlo Ratti. He's the director of MIT's Sensible City Lab. And my other guest is Kimon Onuma, a forward-thinking architect and the president of a company based in California that specializes in developing advanced information systems that control buildings. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Court.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to have you both on. So why don't we begin with both of you explaining a little more about what you do. Carlo, let's start with you.
Sure. I run a lab at MIT called Sensible City Lab and also design office. It's based in New York, in Milan, and in London. And what we do is really look at the impact of new technologies in general on the way we design and live cities. And clearly, the past 12 months have been a huge acceleration in terms of, you know, how we do that, how we really need to adapt to a new situation and use your technologies in a new way, as you were saying.
Kimon, I mentioned your focus on building information systems. Why don't you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. At the core, I'm an architect, and we've been interested in technology, the technology in architecture and how you use it for the design and construction of buildings and city planning for many years now. Actually, it's been over 30 years for us. So we've been into this for a long time, but we also stumbled into becoming software developers ourselves too, because it's about processing information. And we found that we needed to build applications to make our work more efficient and useful. So we started our own applications. We've also built this process called BIMstorm, which is an online collaboration platform to be able to collaborate with participants worldwide, whether they're architects or engineers or city officials or owners. And that's been going on for over 10 years as well, too. So we're excited to be here and talk about where we came from, but where this is all going, too, like you mentioned.
Yeah, just very quickly, you said BIMstorm. What is BIM, I think, must be an acronym. What does that stand for?
Building Information Modeling. It's an industry standard for managing information for buildings, attaching data to three-dimensional models.
So I think what I'd like to do here is to ask Kimon to focus more on building environments in this new milieu, the kind of thing you were just talking about, Kimon, and for Carlo to talk more broadly about cities. And you can both discuss the nature of work in the future in the context of your remarks on those things. But I guess first, do you both agree that white-collar office work has changed forever now? Let's start with Carlo.
Yeah, I think it has. You know, when we look at the pandemic, when we look at the past year, you know, some things will go back to what they were before. Cities have been going through many pandemics in the past, even more devastating pandemics than the present one. You know, think about the 14th century when the plague in Europe kills up to 50-60% of the population of cities. And still, you know, following those pandemics, we always this kind of magnetic force that brings us together, you know, that wants us to be together at the theater, at the stadium, in the city, in public space, has always come back. And so I have no doubt that social distancing will disappear one day in a few months, sooner or later. But some things will not get back to where they were before. And certainly the way we work, I believe, has changed forever. You know, the pandemic in that case has been a big accelerator of something that was happening already before and now is at a different level.
Yeah, I mentioned I'd been working remotely for over 30 years and I started working from Florida in 83, I guess. And it was, I can only do it because I had email at the time, which was very early. I won't even go into that. But, you know, I could not tell my clients at the time that I was working remotely because they would immediately fired me. I had to prove I could do it. So it was kind of a pioneering thing at the time, but now it's routine. Kimon, what do you think to add to what Carlos said about the nature of white-collar office work in the future?
Yeah, I definitely agree with him. And also what you said was interesting, too, about working remotely and having to hide it, because we've had the exact same experience, too. I think with all these great technologies, there's a lot of new ways to work, but there's also the cultural shift that needs to happen. People are afraid a lot of times of new technologies and what implications it has on themselves, on their work, on cities. So, for example, ourselves, we pretty much had to hide a lot of this. We're working remotely or we're not going into the office all the time for many, many years now because we found it to be more efficient. And it's interesting now with the shift that's happened. It was almost overnight, right? I mean, it was one day we were having meetings and flying around the world or whatever. And then all of a sudden, not only us, but our clients had to shift. And some of these clients that we have are government agencies that have not been used to working digitally, whether it's from security perspective or whatever. But I think the expectation now, because of this genie's out of the bottle, it opens new possibilities. Obviously, there's things that are going to hurt and other things are going to be opportunities. But I like to be optimistic about it. I think hopefully it's a good thing that has helped us rethink how we work and live.
Yes. At the same time, you know, let me add a couple of things. You know, the first one is that we're looking at the MIT campus and we're looking at how people, you know, are connecting now just digitally. You know, the campus was closed in March 2020. And since then, you know, we've been working in a distributed way. And what we are seeing is that if we only connect online, if we only work via Zoom and Skype and so on, then, you know, our social networks suffer. Somehow they become weaker. Somehow, you know, there's a very important and powerful component of public space, of physical space. And that's, you know, it creates serendipity. We bump into people we were not expecting to meet and, you know, maybe people we barely know, people we had met 6 months before, and, you know, and out of that can begin a new conversation that maybe might open up new horizons for us. So somehow what I want to say is that, you know, we are not saying that we're going to work only digitally from now onwards. This is not the end of the office, but certainly is a different way of working. And if it is going to be like 2+3 or 3+2, 2 days of home working, smart working, and 3 days in the office or whatever the balance is going to be, still is going to be a huge shift.
Yeah, I think probably it's fair to say that before the pandemic, when the world just suddenly slapped shut, as you said, Kimon, described, I think it was probably like a privilege to work a day or so a week from home, and you had to ask for that permission and would be granted, and you had to prove that you could do it efficiently, and you weren't just spending your day washing, drying clothes, or whatever, going to grocery shopping or whatever. But now I think it's probably going to be a hybrid situation where a mix of that will be prevalent and universal, I guess. But, you know, you're right, Carla, that it's not just the social isolation itself, but it's the psychological and organizational isolation that really restricts business and restricts interaction and restricts creativity and all kinds of functions that we depend on as humans and as professionals, you know. So that's why I said at the beginning, this is a big deal, a big question. So let me kind of shift gears for a minute to a different topic or related topic, but Carlo, the impact on downtown retail businesses that require in-person patronage, like, you know, restaurants and so on, and shops of all kinds, has obviously been enormous, even catastrophic for many. I mean, we keep hearing about the businesses that are folding and the people that are out of work and applying, you know, for jobless benefits and so on. So can you elaborate on that for a minute and what's it doing to cities?
We are certainly going to see other changes in cities. Now, however, regarding food and beverage, you know, and restaurants, bars and clubs, you know, I think that as soon as social distancing will be lifted, I think we'll see a big renaissance. And, you know, if you think about the 1920s, you know, the roaring 20s, they were just after the past pandemic, the Spanish flu of 1917, 1918, you know, and they were a time of incredible social and urban life. And somehow, you know, last summer I was in the US and then I moved to Europe for a few months. And, you know, I was seeing a lot of people in the streets. You know, the lockdown was lifted for a few weeks in Europe. And, you know, it looked like this kind of pent-up demand was very, very evident. So I wouldn't be surprised if you were to see quite soon, really, this kind of pent-up demand for being together, for going and have a drink or eating together, materialize in cities all over the world. Still, this doesn't mean that things are not going to change, you know, both offices, homes, and certainly, as you say, third places, restaurants, bars, and so on, are going to change from a design point of view.
Yeah, I guess the risk, as you mentioned in passing, that there was a brief opening of the lockdown and then they went back into lockdown. And I suspect that may have been a result of the brief opening of the city again. So there's potentially kind of a boomerang effect or a bounce back effect from these things that could be dangerous.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But, you know, I think, you know, that was following the first wave. Hopefully, you know, now with the vaccine and with immunity, that will not happen again. So I'm pretty sure we'll get back to being close to each other. We'll go and enjoy each other's company at the restaurant, at the bar. So I think that will happen sooner or later.
Sounds good. Yeah, I think the vaccine will make a huge difference, obviously. So I think you were suggesting that the roaring 20s were really a function of cities roaring back from... from the restrictions of the pandemic of the Spanish flu in 1918. So you're pretty sure that cities will bounce back from this then? They won't just wither and die?
Well, I'm pretty sure cities, you know, as we were saying before, you know, cities have been going through much more devastating pandemics and they always came back. Somehow the magnetic force that brings us together in cities so that together we can be more than each of us individually. Well, if we look at the past, that has always been stronger than every negative force such as, you know, epidemics, pandemics, or wars. So I'm pretty sure that, you know, this is not the end of cities, but we will see many changes. And certainly, you know, I wouldn't bet too much on office buildings today, in the sense that, you know, certainly even if we were to see like a 10% reduction in overall office buildings in square meters dedicated to office buildings, you know, that could be huge in cities such as New York or London or Milan or Singapore, in global cities that host so many offices.
Yeah, I'm going to continue to talk with you for a minute and then come back to Kimon. But you know, I was just going to ask about that because the lost real estate and sales tax revenues associated with this are obviously huge for cities. And then that's kind of the lifeblood that they live on and the shrinking populations as people move out. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, if we certainly big changes are going to happen in terms of the overall amount of real estate dedicated to office, most likely, you know, we are already hearing about a lot of companies wanting to downsize. We've seen this over the past few months. Bear in mind that the real estate market has a lot of inertia. It moves very slowly. So, you know, the impact of this would be visible probably 1, 2, or 3 years down the line. You're right, the cities might face also pressure because of revenue. I think, you know, they might compensate with other forms of revenue, but certainly that requires a change. And somehow, you know, what we are losing, however, if you're losing square meters, square footage in our office buildings, we might also need to add a few square feet to our homes. You know, we all have been missing kind of one additional room over the past 12 months. And it's not easy to do it in a simple way. You cannot just add one room to every apartment. You know, somehow the way that residential buildings are structured is they cannot be changed that easily. But we can see, look at other solutions. What we are starting to see in some cities, for instance, is small co-working centers. You have at the block level, at the neighborhood level. And so you also get, you know, you can work from home. But if you've got too many people doing a Zoom call at home, you can either go to the office or go to a place closer to your home where you can have more privacy and, you know, the ability to connect. So somehow, you know, I think all of this is going to be part of an evolving landscape. Something will require less space, something more space. It's certainly going to be a massive change, but something that hopefully will make our cities more sustainable.
Yeah, so cities have always adapted, and I guess you're really just saying they're going to have to adapt faster and more now than in previous times. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with two avant-garde architects, Carlo Ratti, who's a professor at MIT, and Kimon Onuma, who's an architect in practice in California, who deals with building information management systems and modeling systems. And we're talking about the impact of the pandemic really on cities, is what it boils down to, and on the nature of work. So, Kimon, with employers figuring out that they really don't need to maintain as much expensive office space as they did until a year or so ago, how are conventional office environments, including building owners, adapting to that new normal? Are you seeing some creative approaches that they're taking to kind of continue having a cash flow and having a business?
Right. Yeah. And as we were talking about earlier, cities are constantly changing and buildings and building owners are obviously a big part of that. And I think this crisis that we have in the pandemic is not new, like we talked about. It's happened over history and cities and buildings have evolved with that. So I think the crisis actually creates opportunity and building owners need to learn how to flex with that. There are going to be radical changes. We're already seeing, like Carlo mentioned, building up the home and building more capabilities of working from home. So there's a shift in needing more space at home. But then what happens when the cities and buildings start opening up again? And I think it's also, if we go back to the technology discussion, it's not going to be all remote and we're all going to be virtual. We definitely are social creatures, so we need to get together. But what I think has happened over the years is we've become lazy about the ease of getting together. You could just hop on a plane and spend 12 hours in the plane and go to a 1 hour meeting and fly back. Yes, it's really great to get together face to face and sit inside a building and have that meeting, but maybe it should be more strategic and it becomes much more valuable when we actually do get together. So what does that environment look like? And I think the city has over time, historically has been a place where we socialize, right? And buildings are part of that fabric. As an architect over the years, I've seen the opportunity because architects typically really focus very much on we need to design and construct this building and deliver it. The owner has asked us to build it. But now with the shift, there's an existing inventory of buildings. And this has been an interest of mine for many, many years now, is not only should we design and process information of what needs to go into a building, but then how do we adjust and know what we currently have to be able to adjust the use of it, for example? Hmm. And unfortunately, in the building industry, with all these great technologies we have, the industry itself has really not advanced as far as efficiency of knowing what we have, for example, or knowing how to adjust and react to the need for more sustainability. So I think building owners first have to take stock in what they have and then see what the demand, if you look at it from a business perspective, it's obviously a demand and supply question. How do they adapt their existing buildings to support this new normal? And how do they even plan for future development? And that's not an easy thing to do. There are going to be challenges with that. But knowing more about the environment, about where we live in, which is information driven, and I think the technology that we're all used to today with running around with our mobile devices and basically getting information on the fly is what owners need to also think in terms of. What do they do with their buildings? How do they adjust them? What risks are there? So even opening up buildings that have been closed is a risk factor too. Buildings start deteriorating, for example, hospitals or even office buildings if the systems aren't running. And then also the new demand for having more space or having people moving in and out. How do you control movement? It's going to change the dynamic, but just like cities are resilient over time, over history, I think we are going to adapt and shift with that change. But it's going to take a group effort to get there.
And my wife and I were watching, while we had dinner last night, watching a program called International House Hunters. And it was a couple who were in, I guess it was Birmingham, England, which is an industrial city. And this is before the pandemic. I guess this thing was filmed because nobody was wearing a mask and they were out and about. But they were looking at two of the three buildings they looked at for apartments were really multi-use buildings, where it was an office building in which some portion of it, like every other floor or something like that, had been converted to living quarters. I thought that was interesting, kind of a hybrid building use, and maybe that's in part some of the future of what we'll see in downtowns.
Just to add to that, I think you're absolutely right. And if you talk to real estate people, traditionally they would talk about asset classes. You know, you've got office buildings, residential buildings. You know, all of that has been blurred by the pandemic, and I think we're going to see much more blurred boundaries between all of this. I mean, our homes are now offices, and our offices are places where we socialize. So I think, you know, those traditional categories are breaking down.
I see, Carlo, and something I looked at on you in preparing for the show, you were talking about hot desking. I hadn't seen that term before. What's hot desking for our audience?
Yeah, no, hot desking was happening before the pandemic. Hot desking is, you know, instead of having your own desk at the office, you know, you go there and every time you go to a different desk. And by the way, this was used even by big companies. I remember visiting Skanska's new headquarters in Stockholm a few years ago. And, you know, large companies, I met the CEO, and the CEO himself was getting to the office and, you know, putting the bag into the small locker and, you know, picking a different place to work every time. But certainly, if we're going to spend more time working from home, again, this idea of 2+3 or 3+2, you know, 3 days of smart working or 2 days of smart working per week, then we clearly cannot have a desk just for us waiting for us at the office. You know, that desk will be always empty. Even, you know, when we are in the office, sometimes we are somewhere else at a meeting and so on. So that means, you know, thinking about one of the consequences of this, if you really want to adapt and make the office more sustainable, is how, you know, everybody can move to a hot desking paradigm. And so you get to the office and, you know, you will sit where there's availability. Maybe you will book your place through a digital platform, but you certainly will not have your desk empty most of the time just waiting for you.
kind of interesting. Another kind of creative adaptation that I saw you had mentioned is the possibility of businesses providing fee-paid areas to conduct virtual meetings, kind of like going to a Starbucks, but on a bigger scale and more professional, so that you could just kind of rent a space to have a meeting.
That's actually a very important issue. And, you know, and by the way, even before the pandemic, there was a court case in Switzerland where actually people working from home were saying, well, okay, I'm happy to work from home. And then, you know, my company should pay for part of my my rent. And, you know, that's that kind of discussion is going to intensify. And I think what we can see is some companies saying, okay, well, you know, that's a slippery slope, you know, then what type of rent they should cover. But certainly maybe giving you whatever a membership for a co-working place. So you can actually go to the closest WeWork or similar or Talent Garden and work from there. So that's certainly another opportunity that the people will explore, I believe, very soon.
Come on, in a pandemic, particularly if you're in an apartment, living there or working there by yourself in particular, buildings can become both claustrophobic and also for everybody in them unhealthy, right? So what about improving both airflow and natural light in buildings? And, you know, what about simple things like elevators and bathrooms? How will buildings in cities in the future adapt, do you think, to those kinds of concerns?
So there's obviously the limitation of physical space. So an elevator or a bathroom, you can't change the environment if it's a fixed space unless you do a renovation, right? But you certainly can, and some of our clients are looking at this as well, too. If you have the building and you know what your, it goes back to knowing what your existing building is about and knowing how to track the movement of people through. So, for example, if you have the flow of people through a building and you can designate how it works or even the timing of it, it really comes down to the sensors being able to know what the building is doing and what the people are doing inside it, right? And I think those technologies have been maturing pretty rapidly, and even the concept of dynamically shifting who's the hot desking we're talking about earlier, right? How do you actually track that person coming into the building, and where are they, and what office did they occupy, and at what time? And if you're in the middle of a pandemic, then maybe that equates to, oh, and then we need to respond to prepare that room for the next group, right? And that goes back to knowing the environment, the condition of the building, who the occupants are, what the situation is, where we stand in time as far as the risk factors. This not only for the pandemic, but for other risk factors as well, too. The building is becoming smarter, and being able to respond to the occupants, I think, is the opportunity that exists with all these approaches.
Yeah, I think that's your main bailiwick is, you know, information management and information modeling and smarter buildings. I mean, can that be used to control airflow in a way that makes them more healthy?
Of course, yeah. So if the buildings are smarter and the systems are tied to that information, it can actually crank up. Like, for example, in a hospital, the airflow through a certain operating room has to be higher. The air changes and how it gets distributed. But knowing something is happening in that room, then if the systems can respond to it, then that makes it a safer environment. A lot of times might mean the need to renovate the building if it doesn't have that capability. So the value is interesting and dynamic, I think, that goes back to the value discussion of how do we look at old historical buildings that don't have these new systems in place? And can they be renovated? Or how do we even plan to adapt their use or change them or do a renovation to make them work like that? There are low-hanging fruit systems. I mean, that some of these sensors and technologies that are relatively easy to, much, much easier today than they were 10 or even 5 years ago.
Carlo, you were going to comment?
Yeah, totally. And no, I absolutely right. You know, it's some of the sensors and the intelligence are very easy to retrofit. And what they do, they're actually turning our buildings into something much more responsive. A little bit, you know, turning the built environment into something that behaves more like the natural environment, where the building can sense a lot of things about life inside and what happens and temperature and airflow and respond to that with different types of artificial intelligence. So I think that's quite exciting and can be retrofitted to many existing buildings. If you do a new building, there's other things that one can do. And, you know, certainly if you centralize all of the HVAC system, that's not the best thing you can do because basically you're just one person is sick. Yes, you know, you can use filters and all what you want, but somehow if one person is sick and if there's a problem with the filters, what you're doing, you're making everybody sick. And so actually one of the things we are doing at the moment, we are designing the first headquarter, a bank headquarter following the pandemic. And what we are doing is we develop a new system, which is we call a smart window, where basically every window exchanges air immediately with the outside. And you've got electrostatic filters in order to make sure that everything is very clean in terms of what comes in and out, in terms of viruses, bacteria, PM10, PM2.5, and so on. But most importantly, you don't need to have a centralized system, which is, again, a useless risk in a big building.
I've read that in using LEDs, you can control lighting in very flexible and creative and unusual ways. I mean, you know, some forms of lighting change mood and that kind of thing. And you can save money by directing the flow of electricity through the building in different ways that conform to the uses going on in the building at the time. You know, the kind of thing you were talking about, where the building becomes more an organic thing that's reacting to its occupants, you know. So I guess there's kind of a brave new world that we're being rushed into faster than we otherwise would have been, right? So, you know, Carla, we're getting toward the end of the show here, Carla, so this is a kind of a big question, but I'd like to see if you can answer it pretty concisely. In technical discussions like the one we've been having, we often tend to overlook the impact of changing cityscapes on the less privileged and on low-income areas that, in this case, have been actually, you know, disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. So what are the challenges there in dealing with those portions of a city that aren't as flexible or as rich as the ones we've been talking about?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, it's every new technology usually brings along a kind of divide. You know, we've seen it at the beginning with digital, with a digital divide. We've seen it with cell phone. And certainly today we got a big divide. You know, not everybody can just work on Zoom. You know, if you are delivering parcels for Amazon, you cannot do that. And you're putting your life at risk. And again, it's very important that we recognize that we analyze that, and then that as society, we find a way to mitigate the divide. Ultimately, that's really a discussion we should all have together in order to minimize it and to help people who today cannot work just digitally.
Yeah, and of course, you know, changes in the value and the property values and all those kinds of things come into play, and how different portions of cities will be used differently. But, you know, we are coming to the end of the show. Kimon, if it's fair for me to ask you this kind of dumb question, if we end up with a hybrid version of remote and in-office work, you know, I was thinking about asking you, what do you think the biggest impacts on the building environment overall will be? But we've talked about a lot of those. But if you could boil it into one kind of bumper sticker, if it's possible to do that, what's the overall, and you can make it a broad thing, but what's the biggest impact that all of this will have on the built environment in cities?
Yes, I'm going to look at it from an optimistic perspective. Everybody's not going to leave the cities. The cities are still going to exist, but they're going to change, like we said. Buildings are going to need to change. The city's going to change. And it's going to create new opportunities. And there's obviously challenges, like we talked about earlier. How do we support all aspects of society?
Yeah.
The disadvantaged, right. Yes, exactly. And I think if we're not building as many buildings, for example, could it be that those resources are used to spread them more around? For example, if you wanted to work in a large company 10 years ago and it was a very successful company in Manhattan, you had to be able to afford to live in Manhattan or San Francisco. What if you could have a hybrid environment and live anywhere you want? Doesn't that change the dynamic nationwide? And I think that's probably the optimistic view that I think we should strive for. How do we make that happen for everybody?
All right. And so, Carlo, again, another dumb question to ask you because it's a big question, but requiring a short answer since we're about out of time. And I think we pretty much answered this really, but I was going to ask you, will urban life ever become, any time in the future, obsolete?
I don't think so. You know, urban life started around 10,000 years ago, and that's when cities started. You know, and humanity found this magic way to be together, to bring us together so that together we can be more than each of us individually. And I think this is going to continue. If you look at the past 10,000 years of human history, what we see is that, you know, that magnetic force that brings us together is stronger than any pandemic.
You know, we are going to have to leave it there. And I think we've covered this topic very well and very interestingly. And I think it's been overall an optimistic projection of what's going to come out of this pandemic in terms of city life. And I want to thank you both, Kimon Anuma and Carlo Ratti, for being on with me on the show today. It's been great having you.
Thank you, Corey, for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.